This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Matt Donovan about his poem, Guy with a Gun, which appears in issue 24 of The Common. Matt Donovan is the author of three collections of poetry and a book of lyric essays. His latest collection, The Dug Up Gun Museum, came out last year from BOA Editions. He is the recipient of a Whiting Award, a Rome Prize in Literature, a Creative Capital Grant, and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Literature. He serves as director of the Boutelle Day Poetry Center at Smith College. Matt Donovan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Would you set the scene for our conversation, just describe where you're living and calling from right now?
I live in South Amherst. So happily is a really gorgeous day. I'm here in my office looking out the window at our peach trees that are not going to bear any fruit this year because of an early frost. And they needed, my kid needs to do some weed whacking around them. So that's the scene in my backyard right now.
That sounds idyllic. I would love to start off with a reading. Would you read your prose poem, Guy with a Gun, for us?
I'd be happy to. Thanks. Guy with a Gun. There's the phrase once again. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun. This time pasted on a Subaru's fender, its rote answer tagging along in a faded Wild West font. Today, though, idling in traffic, instead of knee-jerk counter-arguments and a few remembered memes, I'm thinking of a guy I met in Newtown, Connecticut, who had a son in the first grade at Sandy Hook Elementary School when the shooting took place. His kid is alive, that should be said from the outset, but since the guy was teaching science at the middle school across town when the frantic texts and rumors and lockdown began, for a few hours, he wasn't sure if his son had been shot. His son is alive because the shooter chose to step into a different classroom. But at first, no one knew what had happened, including the guy's wife, as she drove to the school to build gingerbread houses and saw an empty car blocking the road. By then, she could smell gunpowder searing the air. By then, there were sirens in the distance, and soon a police officer held the gathered parents back as a group of children came running, one of whom was covered in blood, and said as she reached for her mom there in the crowd, "I'm all right, but the other kids are dead." All of which is one reason why, when the emails and online postings began claiming that there had never been a shooting, that all of these parents were lying, that the grief of Sandy Hook was being performed, the guy's wife felt compelled to respond, to say what happened had happened. "I was there," she wrote back. "I was there." But the voices continued, a chorus that wouldn't stop calling the guy's wife liar, conspirator, no matter what facts she gave. When the threats began, "I'm bad for people's health," someone wrote on Instagram. "Wait until I find your children." The guy and his wife went to the police and told them there was nothing they could do. Passwords were changed. Users were blocked. The taunts continued. After she wrote, "This stalking needs to stop," someone responded by posting a picture of their son accompanied by the words, "This is stalking, bitch," which is when the guy renewed his permit to carry a gun and began slipping his .45 into its holster whenever he left the house. Perhaps you think you know where this is going. Perhaps this seems as predictable as any sloganeering phrase. Except this story refuses to be reduced to a single phrase. The guy kept his gun close, not knowing what else to do. Whenever he felt its heft, running errands, driving his car, maybe it seemed as if order could be restored. Or maybe the gun made him feel as if he could stop the worst thing from becoming still worse. One morning, the guy drove to the middle school, where he'd been teaching for years, and running late for a meeting, stepped into the building with the gun holstered under his coat. Maybe he just wasn't thinking. Maybe it was carelessness, arrogance, indifference to the rules. The guy knows that the word mistake doesn't cut it. Closer would be some word that doesn't exist, for a fuck-up spilling out of desperation, or perhaps a desire to shield while also circumventing grief and trying to find some kind of foothold in the wake of 20 children being shot in his hometown. But the guy isn't concerned. The guy isn't interested in the words we might choose. Instead, he's thinking about the choices he should have made rather than strolling to the photocopier to prepare for class and watching the machine's light flare a few times across his hands as he pressed down on a book's spine before he was approached by the principal and asked to lift up his jacket. He knew then he'd be leaving in handcuffs. He didn't yet know that he'd lose his teaching license, or that the prosecutor's first offer would be a year in prison with a 4-year suspended sentence, that without written permission, he could never again pick up his son after school, or attend school events, or vote at a public school, that any future employer would see his mugshot online, that some of his friends in town would never speak to him again, and one day he'd find himself standing in a shaded corner of his yard, unemployed, listening to afternoon traffic push past, telling his story to some guy who, for whatever it's worth, didn't know what words to say.
Thank you for reading that. I usually ask podcast guests to explain what their piece is about, but I think yours is pretty clear. But I'm really curious what inspired you to start work on this poem and how that first draft came together.
Yeah, so this is a little bit of a long story, but when I started, I mean, like so many of us, I just was filled with so much grief at our ongoing violence, gun violence in America, and also just rage at our at the impasse and our seeming inability to get anything passed. So I decided any new legislation. I decided I wanted to try and understand the problem more, that there were things about guns that I recognized that I didn't know. And I wanted to go out and talk to people, put boots on the ground and actually have conversations with gun owners and try and get a better handle on why we guns are not have really just seized our imagination as Americans. I wanted to sort of break out of the bubble that I felt like I was living in. So this goes back about 7 years ago when I first started thinking about it. And then gradually my travel and research just picked up more speed and momentum. And there was a period of time there where, you know, I was traveling around, I was talking to people and I was going to communities. I grew up in Northeast Ohio. I wanted to go to Cleveland. I wanted to go to Chicago. I was in Cody, Wyoming. But all along out there, I knew at some point I would have to somehow address Sandy Hook and the shooting that took place there. And I had complicated feelings about it. I definitely didn't want to intrude on anyone's grief, but it felt pointed and a terrible mistake to not address it in any way. And so eventually I decided that I would need to go there. And I set up a number of interviews, including with the person who had been the mayor at the time of the shooting with his name is he goes by Father Bob, the priest that presided over a number of the funerals. I did not want to try to talk to any parents who had lost children in that tragedy, because that did feel intrusive, but I wanted to talk to people that had been a part of it in some way. And as I was doing the research, I stumbled upon this story of this middle school teacher, which I think, as you said, hopefully the narrative there is pretty clear what had happened to him. And it immediately gripped me. It was a story I hadn't heard that I don't think got a lot of national press when it happened. Just the complications of the story really struck me. Here was someone who had very nearly, could have easily lost a child in that event. And then had been, you know, plagued by this harassment by the deniers of the event, and wasn't able to move on with his life in any way. And he had made a terrible mistake, but I understood why he felt the need to protect his family. I understood why he made some of the choices he did, if not all of them. And I understood that it just was a much more fraught and complicated and messier situation than I think that is maybe a little different than how many of us find ourselves thinking about guns. I think, you know, it can be treated in a way that is a red and blue divide, you know, that there's the gun owners and then those that that don't have guns, and it's divided along political lines, and it just spoke to the infinite complications of this, and also the way in which tragedy begets tragedy, and how Sandy Hook has not recovered from that shooting at this point. You know, that was 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago now. So he was someone who I thought I want to understand more of what happened. And when I spent my time there in Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut, I'm not trained as a journalist. I wanted to be so respectful of his privacy. The last thing I wanted to do was somehow make it worse for anyone. And so I had set up these other interviews. I hadn't yet finalized anything with this person the poem is about. But I had reached out to him. I'd written him a letter and I hadn't heard back. And so when I got to town, I actually found his number online and I reached out. And it was a sheer force of will that I reached out to him. But I thought, it seems like an important story to tell. And I didn't want to squander the opportunity. So I called him up and he said, why don't you come out right now? And so I drove out to his house. And then this was incredibly instructive. One of the things that became immediately clear was nobody had ever asked him his side of the story. No one had ever spoken to him. So whereas I was deeply concerned about intruding upon the complicated situation for his family, he was relieved to have a chance to tell his side of it, which had never been asked. And so that was an incredibly powerful thing to understand in that moment. I will say that the book that I had been planning for quite some time had started out as a nonfiction book. I had wanted to write this as a chapter in a nonfiction book. And that book, I had an agent for it. I had a lot of chapters and plans for that book. We could not sell it. So one of the things we learned in the course of going through that is that gun books do not sell. And I think this maybe speaks to the problem too, that either you know a lot about guns and so you're not interested in some gun noob talking to you about guns and gun violence in America, or you're someone who really hates guns and so doesn't want to read a 400-page nonfiction book about guns. Or at least that's how the publishing world sees it. What do I want to say about this? I think that when I spoke to, his first name is Jason. When I spoke to Jason there, I think, he likely might've preferred that it be, a chapter in a nonfiction book, that might've, you know, been a more direct way to get his story out there. And it certainly would have been a longer meditation on the nuances of what led up to this. And in the end, the book, when it was shelved as a nonfiction project, for many, many years, it was probably about a 2-year process or about, actually there's a year limbo, come to think of it, now that I'm clarifying the timeline in my head, where I thought none of this content would ever see the light of day. And there were many interviews that I had, including this one, with Jason from Sandy Hook, where I just couldn't relinquish the content. I couldn't stop thinking about this story, and I wanted to get it out there in some form. And that is when it became that it took on this form, which is somewhere between, I would say, a prose poem and maybe, you know, some sort of active flash nonfiction. So that's a very long answer to your question, but it is, I think, a really complicated and nuanced situation.
Yeah, it's absolutely fine that it was a long answer, because in the process, you answered like my next 2 or 3 questions. So it's perfect. I was going to ask you about handling such a complex issue, you know, with so much gray area in a poem, because I think a lot of people might argue that poems are too short to encompass this complicated situation, or too limited to really go deep on a subject like this with so much nuance. But I actually think it works so well, because we really can't answer all of these questions, you know, that raise here. Yeah.
No, I agree. And I think, I mean, part of my impulse here was certainly to tell the story. I think this is one of the pieces in the book where, as a narrator or someone who's writing this, I wanted to get out of the way to some extent, you know, and I think tell the story, that's part of it. But I also hope in the way that I set it up, with that idea of, you know, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, is obviously the bumper sticker there that is being referred to. And what I wanted to do was somehow present it in the context of a much more complicated situation that couldn't fit into any kind of sloganeering, you know, where it was not something that could be, easily distilled on one side or the other of the issue.
Yeah,
at least
absolutely.
That's the way I saw it.
Yeah. And it's nice, because it's sort of the piece is certainly his story, but sort of framed with you at the beginning. And then at the end, we were reminded that you're sort of hearing this story from him in the yard.
Yeah. And for better, for worse, the speaker, you know, isn't sure, you know, what to say, in terms of, the narrative that he's heard, that there is no easy solace or answer to give. And I think in a lot of the poems in the collection, I wanted to put in my own, fallibility, and have that be a part of it, that it's not trying to, I mean, because there is no easy answer to these issues, I think, around guns. I think one of the things I learned in a lot of my travels and speaking to people is, I mean, first of all, there are plenty of people on a wide political spectrum who are gun owners. You know, when I spoke to people in Cody, Wyoming, I met incredibly liberal people who were activists who also just had guns as part of their world, because of where they lived. But they were, you know, they'd be seen as quite liberal on every political issue, but they just happen to be gun owners. So, I wanted to put my own sort of gradual understanding of the issue to be a part of it, and not be presenting it as someone who had answers, but just as someone who had gone out and had their own understanding of the issue expanded, and had heard a lot of tragic and complicated stories that couldn't be distilled in any tidy way.
Maybe we can talk a little bit more about the collection that this poem is part of. It's called the Dug Up Gun Museum, and I was wondering if you could tell us where the title comes from.
Yeah, well, the title that comes straight out of a real life place in Cody, Wyoming. So, and this actually speaks to the whole issue around the prose and poetry issue as well. I had traveled to Cody, Wyoming to speak to people about what was then a kind of a novel idea of arming public school teachers and staff members as a deterrent for mass shootings. And so, you know, for a visit like that, I had one sort of primary question or one issue that I was driving at, I spoke to a lot of people. I spoke to the sheriff and the superintendent and a variety of teachers and principals. And I was talking to them focused on that particular topic. But as happens so often with my travels, where I would arrive somewhere with a particular question to ask or to address, and there'd be so much that was going on outside of that that I wish I had had time or the bandwidth to say more about. And as I was sort of delineating the chapters of this proposed book, I could just see the ways in which other things that might have interested me weren't going to be able to fit into that particular channel. And the Dug Up Gun Museum is a perfect example of that, where there's a real life place called the Dug Up Gun Museum, as I already said. And I just sort of walked in off the street and started exploring this place. And the owner is someone who has been collecting guns. I mean, it's self-explanatory maybe from the name of it, but had been collecting guns that had been unearthed at a variety of locations all across America. So it could be a Civil War battlefield where weapons were found, or it could be all the way back to revolutionary times or Western expansion and homesteaders. And so he had these glass vitrines that filled the museum that were also filled with dirt and then decayed guns. And sort of like little bits of rocks and little plants to sort of be mimetic of the landscape in which they would have been found. And it really seized my imagination. And it really, to my mind, seemed to speak to this issue of, again, the ways in which guns in America have not only, are occupying our imagination, but have just saturated the landscape. And so it's as if, the earth is growing these things, or our history is so broad with firearms in America that there's nowhere where you do not find them, that the guns are just everywhere. And they're literally on the soil that we walk across every day, which it just seemed like quite a metaphor for our country in this day and age. So that's the origins of the poem itself. And in the end, it was really interesting with the prose book, where I don't think that was a nonfiction book that I was in the end equipped to write. I had the best intentions, I think, and I was really driving after the topics during all of my travels. But in the end, my work is in poetry. And I think there were images and smaller anecdotes and moments that I wanted to interrogate through the tools of poetry, such as metaphor or form. And that was more of what I was equipped to do. And I hope it's a more resonant collection because of its form as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think that absolutely makes sense. The impossibility of really covering all that material and giving it all the attention it needs, whereas with a poem, you can really focus on the aspects of it that are most powerful or most, visual or powerful. Yeah, just that totally makes sense to me.
Well, I agree. And I think, going back to even how I was describing the individual chapters of the book proposal, which, had come to about 100 pages when I sent it in to the publishers, but that it was, in retrospect, too tidy, that it was too much fueled by my own assumptions and limited knowledge from the outset. And everything had to fit into these little slots to make it seem as if it was, expansively addressing the issue. Whereas I feel like poetry in its associative lyric movements is perhaps better equipped to address this issue, which is infinitely varied and incredibly complex. And at times, the tonal range too, that we're a country that has places like, you know, I visited a place like, you know, Machine Gun Vegas, right? Where you just, you know, to go into the gift shop of a place like Machine Gun Vegas, you're seeing the kitsch and, you know, just, you know, the absurd nature of the ways in which guns have seized our imagination. And then that, you know, somehow has to be addressed and interrogated side by side at times with our ongoing tragedies and our gun violence that is so prevalent. And so hopefully poetry at times is the right tool to, at least if it doesn't have all the answers, at least what I hope to do with this book is present a portrait of America. There are times where I really saw it as, I hoped, an act of a kind of portraiture of who we are.
That's a perfect segue to my next point, which was that I was going to ask you to read another poem that we've published in the Common from this collection. It was in our April 2022 poetry feature. The title's a mouthful. I'm going to let you do it, but would you mind reading that poem for us?
I'd be happy to. Thanks. Portrait of America as a Philadelphia Derringer Abraham Lincoln assassination box set replica. Because there's a likeness in the gilded trigger, that flourish of vine trumpet engraved across metal, the way a hinged box becomes a reliquary for the fetishized weapon, and how its replica design helps history tumble toward an eBay listing that includes a dozen shots of the gun rotated just a bit each time, as if ticking along the face of a clock, each hour a new chance to make you pause and press bid. Do you see the resemblance? Of course, it's there too in each related sponsored item. A Civil War chess set where tiny Confederate flags unfurl from the gray side's rooks. Or in the ashtray rimmed with 22-karat gold that uses a dying man as backdrop to the main event of Booth caught midair, forever falling toward the stage while clutching his gun that lets loose a scribble of smoke upon which we can drop our ashes. Or there's the Birth of a Nation poster advertising how, for 3 minutes within its vision of America restored by the Klan, it reenacts the assassination for our pleasure using a series of cuts between Lillian Gish and the audience as a stand-in for us all. Lincoln miming a prescient chill, and Booth skulking near the theater box before lunging in and doing what we've waited to see. Is this footage real? Or are those actors? Lightning Bolt asks. For Reels replies, that Gish was a looker. Portrait of America as YouTube comments scrolled through a night without end. Portrait of America as a portrait of Gish held by her future Klansman Beau a little earlier in the same movie when there was no chance of war brewing in the distance, when everything glowed with possibility if you were the well-meaning white hero in a racist film. If against a backdrop of slaves working the fields, both your swooning pantomime and the orchestra's dragged-out lay motif broadcast how much, even at first glance, you adored this woman you'd never met, who would blame you, given how her eyes lift towards something beyond the frame, and the way a veil plumes her face like smoke, inflaming you, inspiring you to steal the keepsake photo from your friend in a joke that's not a joke, allowing the seeds of your obsession to flourish. Maybe with enough rain and sun, those seeds will grow into more cotton someone will need to pick. Or perhaps they'll take root in the fields, not in the fields, but along a coast that can't be far from the place Lincoln dreamed and wrote about hours before he died. An indescribable vessel that was moving with great rapidity toward a dark and indefinite shore. Portrait of America as exactly that. Portrait of America as you name it, ticking forward, rehashed, brought back once more like Lillian Gish returned to Ford's Theater decades later, cast now as the aggrieved widow-to-be, and the mediocre made-for-TV movie The Day Lincoln Died, where the same trigger squeeze makes her become a punchline we've already heard. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? Portrait of America as a joke about dying that will never die, as yet another aftermath's other than that refrain.
Thank you for reading that. This piece travels quite a distance. You know, it starts with eBay, goes through a lot of history through sort of these movie moments, these pop culture moments. I'm sort of curious, are there parts of this poem that surprised you while you were writing it? Like, did it go where you thought it would?
No, that's a great question. I think when writing a poem in general, I'm definitely on the lookout and hoping that I will be surprised by things. If I know where things are going from the outset, that typically turns into a very failed poem for me. So my process is incredibly messy. So it's a lot of notes and no sense really of where I might be led. And for this particular piece, I was... There are a lot of, I think one of the recurrent motifs in the collection, or one of them, is ways in which we might fetishize these weapons that I'm talking about. So whereas there's actual guns and actual tragedies caused by firearms, there's also the ways in which we're perceiving them, I think, is something I'm really interested in. And it just was, when I came across this eBay posting, which is verbatim from what I saw, just was really struck by the ways in which again, the weapon is fetishized and just removed from any sense of it as a device, a tool that has been designed specifically to kill people, and the ways in which the human cost of the guns is just very much removed from this thing. So then, you know, I started to look into that idea of Lincoln's assassination, which led to Birth of a Nation. And then that's where I came across, again, a lot of this is just research itself pulling me forward, but the fact that Lillian Gish was in the same scene, but for different movies and in different roles. So that seemed to speak to, I was interested in the ways in which that spoke to recurrent history and these cycles of violence that we have. And then I spent some unfortunate time rewatching scenes from Birth of a Nation. And in that scene where the boyfriend is sort of courting her, there was the gesture where he is hiding the portrait as a joke, and then it's very clear that he's not joking. And at some point that triggered for me, or at least I saw this association with, that what is probably a very familiar joke, that idea, it's almost a cliche. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? Which is a way of, you know, it's a joke that references this historical moment, but it's also a joke that seems indicative of our country's ability to move on, and the ways in which gun violence is normalized, and the ways in which we seem to be striving to look past it. And so that's where the joke, back to your question, I was surprised that the idea of the joke came forward to such an extent, and certainly that's where the poem ended. And then I was also surprised, as I structured this collection, that I ended up ending the whole book with this poem, which is, it's not a, there's no resolution here at all, right? I find the idea of this ending the book kind of a horrific idea, that it's moving already, trying to look past a moment of aftermath and saying that other than that, you know, what else can we talk about? And that is already locked in as a tragic refrain for our country. But once I did come up with that idea, it was hard to find anything else that, to my mind, at least for the other poems that spoke to our moment. You know, I think the normalization of violence is something that is one of our country's great tragedies, and something to which I don't see a resolution to. So it, in the end, it unfortunately seemed really fitting as a place of closure.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, unfortunately. So you've been running the Poetry Center at Smith College for a few years now. And I was a Smithy and I took a great poetry class there before I graduated, which was in 2009.
Oh, were you a Smithy? I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the Poetry Center. But yeah, it's been a long time since I was there. Would you just talk a little bit about what it's been like running the center? It's been around such a long time, but I know you've been there a couple of years.
Yeah, it'll be 5 years this August that we moved to this area. We have been living out in New Mexico. I love it so much. This is by far the best job I've ever had. As you must know, it's just such an incredible community of students and faculty, and I love all my colleagues. And then I feel so beyond belief lucky that this is my job, to think about bringing in poets who will somehow speak to the community of students there. And I feel like, my job is not to sort of trundle together, these are my favorite poets. But it's, to really give some careful thought to who can offer us something in this moment that might change our idea about poetry, that might enlarge our sense of what contemporary poetry might be. And that for me has been one of the greatest pleasures of being at Smith is I teach a class that is tied into the poetry programming. And so the basic structure of the class is we'll talk about a poet's work. And then the next week, in lieu of a class discussion, we'll have that poet, we'll go to that poet's reading and have a chance to hear the poet in conversation with someone in addition to hear the work. It's become a very large class. I have over 100 students pretty consistently who are taking that course. And so first of all, I think that speaks to the incredible nature of Smithies, where it's not just the poetry nerds who are coming out to this class. It's students from, I think, almost literally every discipline across campus who have an authentic interest and curiosity about poetry. But it's also people who I think know that poetry might be more than what they might have experienced in high school, which unfortunately, there's a lot of work that needs to happen in terms of both curriculum and pedagogy with poetry. And so, for a lot of these folks, the readings they would be coming to at Smith might be the very first poetry reading they'd ever experienced. We've had so many even poets come to campus who will, come and talk to our students and say, when I was in high school, I didn't know that poetry was something that was done by living, breathing people. And I thought it was something that dead white dudes did a long time ago. That contemporary poetry can be something that speaks very specifically, to this moment, to their lives, to their identities, and might complicate and enlarge their sense of the world and themselves is something that is absolutely just, such an ongoing pleasure at Smith for me.
Yeah, that does sound like a good job.
It is the best.
Well, always our last question for podcast guests. What are you working on now? What's next from you?
Oh, gosh. Well, thanks for this question, too. I'm working on just small poems that never mention guns and in which nobody gets shot. I spent many years working on this project, trying to, think about guns in our country. And I'm trying to write just different kinds of poems, just different topics. And it's been really refreshing and cathartic for me to just find new ways into a different kind of content.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely necessary and deserved.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Matt Donovan, thanks so much for joining us. It's been really great to talk with you.
Oh, thanks so much. It was such a pleasure being here. I really appreciate all your great questions.
Listeners, you can read Matt's poems and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.